A second domestic stabbing on Oahu last week again put domestic violence back in the headlines. One of the cases was witnessed by a 12-year-old boy, the other by a 16-year-old, according to the head of the Domestic Violence Action Center. Nancy Creedman says our community's children who witness this level of trauma can bring horrible outcomes unless there's necessary support. Better would be intervention before the violence can happen. But will the community rise to help ensure that it doesn't? Nancy Creedman joins us now. Thank you for the time this morning.
Oh, you're welcome. It's nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. As you look at these two cases and others that have been happening recently, what's your read of what's happening in our community? Is this, in fact, getting worse?
Well, we see violence in the family every day at the Domestic Violence Action Center. It really just captures the community's attention when there are these, you know, grievous crimes that we saw this week. Those kinds of crimes, of course, are heartbreaking and heart-stopping and very, very important reminders to each one of us that domestic violence is a potentially fatal crime. We have to remember that every day of the year, there's something each of us can do to help our neighbor, our coworker, our family member, our fellow parishioner. The problem of domestic violence does not discriminate. And so the only time the community remembers domestic violence is occurring at the level it is when there is a fatality. And so I'm grateful to be here to remind everybody that at our community's domestic violence programs, we're doing this every day of the year, all day long.
Because you do this every day, all year long, you also see numbers that the rest of us don't see. From what you are witnessing in the number of cases that you see, the number of calls that you get, is this spiraling or is this just simply taking our attention because these cases hit the headlines?
We don't necessarily see a spike in the incidence of domestic violence. We consider it a success when more people call us. That means we're communicating effectively to our community, letting them know that we're available to help. It means that people have finally gotten the courage or reached a threshold where they're able to ask for help. So that's a good thing. I don't see an enormous increase in the incidence of domestic violence. I think it's a good thing for us to take a more careful look at it when given this opportunity, when the spotlight is shining on the problem of domestic violence. But I wouldn't say it's increasing. I would say that it's a problem with a pretty firm grasp on our community's families.
That said, and because we've had other cases where they've made headlines and we've all turned our attention for the moment to domestic violence, how do we take this incident or these two and make it something better, something different, and begin to give much more reason for communities to stand up?
Well, we simply can't do it alone at the Domestic Violence Action Center. We need our entire community engaged with us. We need business. We need faith-based communities. We need healthcare institutions. We need academia. We need neighbors. We need families. Everybody has to see that domestic violence is costing all of us, not only in money, but in spirit and in potential. So my plea is always that although I'm here as a voice for those who are unable to speak, I need everybody to stand with us when we're trying to figure out what is the pathway forward, what are the challenges we can overcome, what are the barriers that are in the way. We need some really good leadership from our elected leaders and our appointed leaders. We are facing some pretty frightening and potentially grave setbacks from the federal administration. Our expectation is that our city and state legislators will rise up to meet that gap in funding, in advocacy, in policy development, in program development. We all have to have both feet in this thing.
From the conversations that you've had with city and state leaders, are they really prepared to take that on beyond some of the rhetoric that we may hear?
I would have to say I haven't seen a willingness or a preparedness. I haven't seen the kind of enthusiasm that is called for. We had a very dismal legislative session in 2017. We did not have one domestic violence bill, not one bill focused on gender-based crimes or violence against girls, women, children passed. That would have effectively created some opportunity, some accountability, and some programs. That's pretty heartbreaking for us. We're working hard to advocate, educate, and illustrate the importance of collaborating as a community with all sectors and with all resources and all hands on deck. We need it.
That seems to be a rather bleak picture, given the fact that you're already expecting that there's going to be a lack of funding from the federal government to not have both, you know, county, city, and state lawmakers engaged with you in this, despite what people may talk about getting down to the real work of it. What will you do?
Well, we never pass up an opportunity to get together with our community. We accept invitations to speak, to engage, to participate in dialogue. We reach out. I mean, it all sounds so bland, but we just have to stay with it. We are trying to figure out how to go forward into 2018, figure out what bills we'll revisit, we'll resurrect, try to figure out what it is that we could do differently. We haven't done anything that we can point to that would have resulted in a lack of action. It seems to me like there was quite a bit of chaos during this past session, and perhaps they were just not able to focus on this particular problem. I think there's a kind of complacency that is set in about problems like domestic violence. We handled that already. We've got shelters. We've got, you know, whatever. But every community problem has its roots in domestic violence. What goes on in the home goes with people to school, goes with people to work, costs increase health care dollars, impacts employers. Everybody has to see that they have a stake in helping the Domestic Violence Action Center and law enforcement and courts and corrections address the problem of domestic violence. Battered women are homeless. Nobody is talking about that.
What do you think has to happen to get that conversation going in the business community, in the faith-based community, throughout academia, in non-government sectors, where maybe that might create some pressure in the government sector?
Right. You know, I don't think that there's one thing that has to happen. I think it's a menu of things that we must continue to do. We have to stay vigilant. We have to use our voices. We have to speak out. We have to keep collaborating. We have to keep inspiring our allies, those people that we can see who are our allies. There's been a pretty impressive civic engagement post-Trump's election. I find great heart in that. Those are the people we're going to go to, the Women's March, J20, Indivisible, the organizations that are mobilizing on the ground. Even though their agendas are slightly different, they can see that there's a relationship between misogyny and domestic violence and racism and classism. All of those things contribute to the problems of domestic violence.
What about the business community? You mentioned that obviously if there's something happening in the home, it will also go to work with the person who is involved in domestic violence in one way or the other. In one of these cases where the woman was working for the ABC stores, have they at all reached out to you or you to them to be able to push that agenda with some of their employees?
Yes. ABC Stores has been very, very responsive. I did offer the services of the Domestic Violence Action Center to the employees, co-workers of the woman who was murdered last week. It's a startling thing to have somebody that you know stand beside you, work with you, get murdered in that fashion. So we reached out to the ABC stores, and they were absolutely endorse, welcome us to come in and work with the co-workers and reach out to the family through ABC stores. They're going to need a lot of support going forward. The trauma is indescribable to any of us who've never lost a family member this way. As a community, I think we've done a pretty lousy job laying the foundation for supporting children who are witnesses to domestic violence. We need our lawmakers, our legislators, our policymakers, our foundations, and our business to help us create effective programs for children. They are our next generation.
You seem to be asking a different shade of the question, what does it mean to be Ohana?
Yeah.
Nancy Creedman, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nancy Creedman is the Chief Executive Officer at the Hawaii-based Domestic Violence Action Center. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, a memoir of a rich and adventurous life. But first, your backyard quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're looking back to an event that put Hawaiian music on the national map. It was a World's Fair of sorts in San Francisco in 1915, created to celebrate the completion of the Panama Canal. It also was the 400th anniversary of the Spanish explorer Vasco Nunez de Balboa's arrival at the Pacific Ocean. The fair's Hawaiian Music Pavilion became its most talked-about attraction, launching international careers for several local artists. Sales of recordings and sheet music, decorated with tropical images, went through the roof, with artists like steel guitar master Joseph Kikuku and Keoki Awai's Royal Hawaiian Quartet, the house band at the pavilion. Hula also was featured, and the whole country fell in love with the music, dance, and exotic image of the islands. The event had a ripple effect on the world of American music as blues, pop, and country artists for generations afterward added the whine of the steel guitar to their music. It's the name of this watershed event that we're looking for, and if you know it, call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689.
Aloha, this is Joey Manahan. If you want to listen back to a show, visit the conversation page at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tsukiyama has had an eventful life and a long one. At 96, he can look back on membership in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, wartime adventures in the jungles of Burma for the Military Intelligence Service, and a distinguished law career. His new memoir is called My Life's Journey, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Ted.
Hi, good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've lived a lot of the modern history of Hawaii, it would seem.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, you were let's take it to the war years. You were how old when the war broke out?
20.
20 years old.
20, yeah.
And what were your circumstances at the time?
I was a junior at the University of Hawaii.
Uh-huh. And in were you in the ROTC unit there?
Yes.
So what was that like? What were your feelings when Pearl Harbor happened?
Well, I was in the ROTC, just as the name implies, Reserve Officer Training Corps. We're preparing to get a officer's commission to serve as an officer in the U.S. Armed Forces in the event of a war.
And then along comes Pearl Harbor. What?
Yeah, it hit when I was a junior at the university.
So what changed for you?
Well, I think it changed for life, everyone's life.
Yeah.
War was entirely different.
Well, what happened to your ROTC unit, for example?
Well, that morning we got called out. The ROTC was called out and was immediately converted into the Hawaii Territorial Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually I guess within a year's time, the War Department decided to form the now well-known 442nd Regiment.
Right.
So they called for Nisei volunteers. I remember they called for 1,500, and they got over 20,000 volunteers. Yeah. They could have made 4 or 5 battalions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where did that enthusiasm come from, do you think?
I don't think it's enthusiasm. I think it's just a natural response to respond to the country's need for service in times of emergency.
Sure. And yet, the command structure of the military at the time wasn't at all sure about the loyalty of young Japanese Americans.
Not back in the Pentagon.
Uh-huh.
And that's why it took about a year before they finally came around to deciding that, I guess we can trust these guys to form a all-Nisei battalion and issued a call for volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they had a quota of 1,500.
Do you think they were surprised by the response, the command?
I don't know. I don't know if they were surprised, but I think, I think if it was publicized and made a campaign, they could have gotten many times
gotten
more.
Gotten even more.
Oh,
huh?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's a passage in the book that really struck me, and it had to do with how you felt about the soldiers that you were fighting,
mm-hmm.
the young soldiers of the Japanese Empire,
mm-hmm.
and that before you saw them,
mm-hmm.
you had a lot of anger. You remember that?
Oh yeah, Pearl Harbor Day. They made the sneak attack and attacked Hawaii, and we suffered a lot of casualties and all that.
Let me just read you a passage that struck me from the book, because you had said you had vowed on the day of the December 7th attack, I'm quoting now, that I would knock down the first Japanese soldier I met, smash his face. With all this as background, I was invited to inspect the Japanese POW camp. Entered the compound with a big chip on my shoulder, But instead of the arrogant fighting machine we had been taught to expect, I was greeted by a pathetic, fearful, dispirited group of young rural kids. And you said, any impulse I had to physically punish the prisoners quickly vanished. That must have been a surprising moment, yeah? They were just kids.
Yeah, from that Pearl Harbor day morning on, I vowed, you know, Japan was the enemy, and I'm going to retaliate and punish anyone that I could in retaliation.
And that was the feeling of your fellow?
I think so, yeah. I know, because this would impugn and challenge our loyalty.
Yeah.
And maybe there was a natural instinct that, hey, we got to show our true colors. And so, you know, like when they call for 1,500 volunteers, they got over 20,000.
You got over 20,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did you end up in the military intelligence service?
Well, I was part of the group, you know, including Dan Inouye, mm-hmm, and all them that volunteered and was accepted for the 442nd.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at Camp Shelby, and so that was about 3,000 or the 3,500. But the military intelligence had a higher priority on Nisei, who had some knowledge or competence of the Japanese language.
Mm-hmm.
So they pulled out about 150 of us, I think,
mm-hmm,
and sent us to a special military intelligence training school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at Camp Savage, Minnesota. So we got transferred from Mississippi to Minnesota from infantry combat to military intelligence,
mm-hmm,
learning Japanese and fighting the Japanese with their own language.
So you had some Japanese, but you got trained in...
All of us, Nisei, before the war, our parents forced us to go to at least 1 hour every day. After everybody else was out through school at 2:30,
uh-huh,
we had to go to another school and spend at least an hour learning Japanese language and culture.
So what were your duties in the MIS, in the military intelligence service?
Well, there were various segments of intelligence that you know were needed, like directly interrogating Japanese prisoners or translating Japanese war diaries and stuff, mm-hmm, like that. But I was assigned to the Air Force, and had to put on a set of earphones and intercept Japanese fighter aircraft as they flew over China,
wow,
and Burma,
uh-huh,
and intercept what the pilots were yelling to their towers.
That had to be information that had to be turned around in seconds, I would think.
Well, the main thing was that we translate the Japanese into English and just send it upstairs, and I don't know what they did with that,
yeah,
information, but we were the converters of the enemy communication.
Right. And you had to be pretty close to enemy lines to do that, didn't you, just to even...
No, fortunately, you know, it was radio intercept, so we were in some base way in the back in the safe areas in the rear,
uh-huh,
rear echelon, not up directly confronting the enemy, which was at that time in Burma.
Yeah.
And they were being chased out of Burma, and they were pushed into Thailand. And that's when the American Army from India, we were flown into Burma,
mm-hmm,
and then pushed the Japanese out into China.
for a long time, the Japanese were winning in that part of the world, weren't they?
Well, at that stage of the game, yeah, they were at the border. In fact, at one point, they entered India at a place called Imphal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they had conquered and occupied Burma and had invaded part of India.
After your service in the Second World War, you made your way back to Hawaii and were part of that whole sort of what happened in Hawaii after the Second World War, you know, I guess they'd call it the Democratic Revolution, really remade Hawaii society. What path did you take after you mustered out?
Well, at that time, my main objective was to continue my education, which was interrupted. Mm-hmm. I was a junior at university.
Right.
And I wanted, of all things, to get my degree and even go on into graduate school and law school.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, I eventually did.
What made you want to become an attorney?
I think even before the war, I had aspirations.
Uh-huh. What did you do with that career? What did you do as an attorney?
As an attorney, I didn't do the bread and butter, going to court and all that stuff. And I ended up really in as an arbitrator.
Finding other ways to resolve disputes, yeah?
Yeah, this was to arbitrate disputes between the labor unions and the employers.
Of which there were many in Hawaii in the years after the war, right?
Yes, you know, they had their labor disputes.
Yeah.
And the arbitrator was a peacemaker.
Sure.
Called in from the outside to intervene and try to get the parties to.
And that became a big focus of your law career, didn't it? Mediation.
I became, I think I made my niche as an arbitrator.
Yeah. What's the value of it? What's the value of arbitration?
Well, it fulfilled part of my personal, not ambitions, but, you know, I felt that resolving disputes, you know, a mediator, arbitrator gets in the middle, mostly between the unions and management,
mm-hmm.
and to get the disputing parties to resolve their differences and bring, in this case, stability and peace to the labor management environment.
That's not always easy, is it?
Well, fortunately, I think an arbitrator was sort of highly regarded,
mm-hmm.
and so there was a responsibility which you felt you had to carry out, and of course not abuse the authority,
mm-hmm.
but to use it to the best interests of dispute resolution and peace and stability in the labor management industry.
It's a good goal, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, this memoir is a memoir of a pretty good life. It seems as it's been a pretty good life, hasn't it?
Yeah, I haven't read it recently anyway. But let's see, Kaufman compiled that, huh?
Yeah, Tom Kaufman. Yeah. Well, I have read it, and it is quite a life, and I thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Tsukiyama is the author of My Life's Journey from Watermark, Publishing. He'll be signing copies this Sunday at 12:30 at United Methodist Church in Honolulu.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii Parents.
With the ouster of Jill Takuda as Ways and Means Chair, Senator Donovan Dela Cruz has arguably become Hawaii's most powerful senator. But will a man known for his ties to big business, backroom deal-making, and ethics concerns be the right person for the job? Civil Beat reporter Nathan Eagle has a reality check. Hi there.
Hi, how's it going?
Not bad. We'll see what happens in a very changed situation, I'm sure, as now that Donovan Dela Cruz has taken over as Ways and Means Chair. How did he help to orchestrate all of this?
Well, an opportunity was created near the end of the legislative session earlier this month, late April, when Takuda, as you mentioned before, and her counterpart in the House, Sylvia Luke, kind of came to a stalemate on the bill to fund the Honolulu Rail Project. That created an opportunity, and a resolution was circulated by Senator Kai Kahele to replace Takuda with Dela Cruz right as the session came to a close.
And was that done with the knowledge of Senate President Kochi?
It was indeed, and with his blessing.
So with all of that in play, how, in fact, has this been a transition between Jill Takuda and Donovan Dela Cruz in taking over a very important committee chair?
Well, from what I'm told, the transition itself, even just the logistics, changing staff and stuff, has been really rocky so far. He just took over officially last week. Her staff left. His is coming in. So it's kind of getting up and running at this point. But a lot of it remains to be seen since it's in the interim right now. So he'll have an early kind of small kind test coming up later today, even when the Council on Revenue meets. That they could upgrade their financial forecasts for general funds. They could lower it. Either way, that's going to be millions of dollars more or millions of dollars less, and he's going to be in the position to decide what to do about that.
That's a task-oriented thing that's going to be happening later today, but in terms of building out of not only staff and creating some sense of continuity where there might not be any, but also in being able to build out some sort of coalition with other senators. Is that going to be possible for Donovan Dela Cruz?
Well, Dela Cruz is one of the leaders based on what other colleagues have said, of the Opihi faction. So with that group, which includes Senators Michelle Gadani and others, there's about 10, I think, at present. He's already got that base. That's pretty good. Now he's going to be looking to try to recruit maybe some of Takuda's faction, which is just a few people. It's going to be tricky. Obviously, they're very upset. And then looking to others that have been on the outs lately. So he's going to be looking everywhere he can to try to get those 13 votes, basically, is what you need in the 25-member Senate to make anything happen.
That's the big question. And I think that's the question that you're asking in the piece from today, is he the right man for the job, given all of the baggage that he brings with him, along with considerable talent?
Exactly. It's an important question. He's got a lot of supporters, people in his district who love that he's able to bring home so many millions of dollars for different projects. They like how he thinks outside of the box. They're very creative, very driven, very tough, too, on departments. But then you've got some detractors who are very concerned about, hey, we're not seeing things done as openly as we think is possible, and some of those kind of concerns.
And why do they have those concerns about Sunshine, for example?
Well, it stems all the way back from when he was council chair, the youngest council chair, I think, at age 30 that the city council here has ever had. It was, for instance, serial one-on-one communications was one of the things he was dinged for by the Office of Information Practices. That was involving council reorganization at the time and the practice of going from one council member to the next to the next to the next to kind of come up with that decision behind closed doors instead of bringing it up during a council meeting and just having that discussion publicly.
Well, that was a little while ago. We'll see what happens now that he's Ways and Means Chair and what this means for our future. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org. Today, featuring reporter Nathan Eagle. Hawaii often feels good about its low unemployment rate, still now at 2.7%. Even during deep recessionary times, it was still considerably lower than the national average. The rate we usually talk about often masks the underemployed or people who have been looking for a job and then dropped out of the process. Meanwhile, many Hawaii employers often say they can't find qualified people to take jobs that still go wanting. I recently sat down with Pono Chong, the Vice President for Business Advocacy and Development at the Chamber of Commerce of Hawaii, to talk about Hawaii unemployment and the rate that he and the Chamber might consider to be a better reflection of reality.
So I'm not an economist, but I do think there is both the statistical data as well as probably the anecdotal data that you're referring to a lot. Statistically, there are two levels. I think the one you're talking about that we all hear, right?
2.7%. Life is good.
That's right. That's called statistically the U3 number, and that's the standard number that I think the Bureau of Labor Statistics uses. Some people have said the U6 number is probably closer to what is reality, both in terms of those who are employed, but also in the workforce, being able to get the jobs that they want, and also that there are enough jobs to make their participation in looking viable. So I think it's probably a mixture of the two. I think U6, we're still under the national average, but it's high. It's probably double what the U3 number is, or maybe even triple. I think it's, 8%. So I think that shows what you're alluding to is it kind of shows that while a lot of people have work, some of the work may not be either enough or be in the field that they are looking for specifically.
When you talk to members of the Chamber of Commerce, mm-hmm. and they tell you some of their anecdotal stories about trying to find enough people, particularly when you have a new concern that's opening and they're looking for great people, what happens seems to be that people get poached. And so you have the same pool of people moving around and around again. Is that what you see?
We do hear a lot of anecdotal stories of poaching. We also do hear some employers trying to further train or educate their existing staff. But I think at 3%, as economists say, that's technically zero unemployment because the other 3% are retired, transitioning, whichever. So really there's not anyone to pull from. And I think that is a problem facing employers as well as our economy, which is tied to a lot of issues that you talk about on this show.
The question is, how do we move through that when people clearly need to have jobs mm-hmm. and may be looking for those jobs? And there are employers that have jobs going wanting, but for a lack of skill or, in some cases, the lack of a wage that can be paid to someone to make them attractive.
Right. So I think for the fields where there is a technical or educational requirement necessary, I think the Chamber, we have programs that we're now working with both K-12, Department of Labor, the University of Hawaii, to try and establish pipelines by sector. So I think trying to look at it that way in terms of a long-term solution. And we're not talking about high school students. We're going all the way down to middle school and even further to make sure they understand that there is opportunity in Hawaii for them. With that, comes the issue of the cost of living in Hawaii. And I think that has always been an issue. You've talked about it many times on this show, is people leaving for the mainland because it is too expensive to live here. The lack of housing supply has created a huge spike in prices. And I think that's something that Paul Brubaker and many other economists have continually warned about, is the housing inventory. Going to your last part about the issue of wages, I think many of our employers, many of our members, try and provide the best wage that they can in the business that they are in, and many times are paying a premium just to get those employees in the door, because people do leave for, you know, 25 cents an hour to another employer. So there is huge competition for employees, and a lot of employers are trying to offer better wages for that, keeping in mind that with that, there is prepaid health care and many other benefits that are included. I mean, when you talk about hourly wage, prepaid health care can add anywhere from $3 to $7 more per hour in benefits, depending how many hours you work, because employers have to offer it if you work 20 hours a week only. So, you know, that's 1,000 hours, and some employers are paying $600 a month.
That would be consistent, though, across the board. If anyone were working 20 hours or more, that would kick in. But the bottom line of this seems to be, for the employers at least, how do you get good people who are going to stay with you so you don't have to keep churning them, retraining others, and hoping that you're not going to have to continually, you know, feel that whole process? Doesn't that mean, though, that at the get-go it would be maybe a little bit smarter to just say, hey, we're going to offer a much better wage, and that way we can be picky and people are going to want to stay and make this an employment option of choice?
I think for each business, they have to make sure that it fits into their business model and cost structure. I think while the economy seems to be doing well and is strong, it's constantly shifting. I mean, we see a lot of that in the retail space, not just locally, but nationally. And with that comes each business owners and managers' dilemma of how to balance that between paying the wage that gets the right people in the door and retains them, and at the same time gets the customer in the door to be able to support the enterprise that you are in. And I think that's the tough balance for a lot of companies. I have not met an employer, any of our members, who say, I want to give the minimal I can. Most of them value their employees. They want to take care of them. They provide other benefits beyond what the law requires. And every compensation package is different.
Having just said that, when you talk about a company that's looking to expand, that's going to put another shop here or another restaurant there, and to know that this is the climate in which they are going to be opening, then shouldn't that be factored into all of those business plans to expand? Because it seems like in many cases people want to expand, but they're expanding based on a plan that in some ways seems to be artificial in terms of the employees. Here's what we can pay, and that, you know, if everything goes to plan, this is what the restaurant will do, and therefore it looks like a good move to expand. But then to find that they can't actually hire people at what they're offering seems to be, they would know going in.
I think for some of them, and exactly what you said, it has to pencil out before they open it and before they decide to open that new store, that new restaurant, or new business.
But so, you've seen those that have opened and they've said, we can't find people and we can't open because we can't find people.
Right. And that's where I guess what I'm trying to say is, for the chamber's perspective, right, we are not privy to each business's individual situation or their financials. And that's why it is up to them to try and figure it out. And, you know, that's part of the marketplace, because if you go into a business that isn't well-staffed and you receive bad service, then they've made, and whether it's because of compensation or something else, then they've made that decision and they may not be successful, which in case is going to be their financial loss and their risk on the line.
But it also affects all businesses, and it affects the business climate. As the chamber, do you feel any responsibility to remind people of this as they look at potential expansion, even in the good times in which we still find ourselves?
Yes, absolutely. And we have a lot of seminars. We have a program called Focus On, that is free to small businesses. And it touches on all of these things: soft skills for employees, your financial structure, how to keep and retain good employees. So constantly we have programs for our members to keep them at the forefront of what is going on in the marketplace and how they can use that knowledge to better their business.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Pono Chong is the Vice President for Business Advocacy and Development at the Chamber of Commerce of Hawaii.
Aloha, I'm songwriter Tim Rose, and you're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we reminded you that Hawaiian music was once the hottest style of popular music in the country, and we looked back at the event that started it all. It was held in San Francisco in 1915, a worldwide expo in celebration of the completion of the Panama Canal. It was also a major rebuilding event for the Bay Area, which had been devastated by the great earthquake and fire of 1906. The Hawaiian Pavilion, which featured hula and musical performances, quickly became the hottest ticket at the fair, and nationwide began a craze for things like all things Hawaiian that was underway. You can hear the steel guitar influence in some of the earliest blues and country music recordings of the early decades of the 20th century, and later in the popular songs of artists like Bing Crosby. Steel guitar pioneer Joseph Keikuku was one of the first to benefit, along with ukulele master Keoki Owai, leader of the house band of the Pavilion. The fair put Hawaiian music on the world map, and it's remembered as the Panama Pacific International Exposition of 1915 in San Francisco, California.
And Beth Ann, Marty Sanders knew the answer and called us from his car on King Street. I assume he pulled over before he did that, but he's today's winner, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
So you guys don't have an inkling of what you're about to see if we go in there.
No.
But it's a, you know, privileged area.
Is this the thing about which we spoke?
Oh. There was something on the faces.
Oh, holy moly.
They fill the eye sockets.
Oh, my God. There's like a...
They puff out the lips.
Oh, man. On the next radio lab.
A large, ugly growth.
Tumors.
Famous tumors on the next radio lab.
Saturday morning at 10.
There are a great many different activities going on throughout the state, and Morning Edition host Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar, sometimes very under the radar, Derek.
Yes, yes.
Here's an evening of musical storytelling.
That's happening tomorrow on Oahu, and it's called Heart and Music, a cabaret and reading series. It features nine local artists performing musical selections from the worlds of cabaret and contemporary musical theater. Light refreshments will be served, and it's happening at 6:30 tomorrow in the Lutheran Church of Honolulu on Punahou Street. And visit our website for ticket information about that.
And should you happen to be on Hawaii Island, you can get an update on the Botanical Garden in Kona.
Yes, Miley Melrose is president of Friends of the Amory Greenwell Ethnobotanical Garden, and she'll talk about the current situation of the garden and discuss the life of Amy Greenwell, who transformed her property near Captain Cook by planting native and Polynesian-introduced plants. This free talk is tomorrow at 5:30 in the Kealakekua Public Library.
And that's got quite a rich source of plants, too.
Yes, it does.
And there's a free event tomorrow that encourages older adults to take action toward a healthier life.
Yes, it's called National Senior Health and Fitness Day. It's tomorrow at Kahala Mall from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. There will be a Zumba demonstration, a class on preventing falls, a plus Tai Chi line dancing, sweating to the oldies, and a cooking demo. And there's a drawing for a trip to Las Vegas. So that's enough reason to go just, you know, right there.
Yeah.
And it's tomorrow at Kahala Mall from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. And it's free.
And whatever you do, don't fall, because there'll be a class in how not to do that.
Yes.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Thank you.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that might be going on under the radar. You can always find out more about those and other events on our website, HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele. Join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater in St. Paul with our guests, the one, the only Paul Simon, Andrew Bird, and the hilarious Maria Bamford. We also had some of my fellow Punch Brothers in the band, plus Sarah Jarosz, Rich Dworsky, and the Royal Academy of Radio Actors. Hope you'll join us.
Hear a Prairie Home Companion Saturday evening at 6.
That's going to do it for us for this Tuesday. We hope you'll plan to come back with us tomorrow. We're going to talk about the lessons of the King Tides with DLNR's Coastal Lands Coordinator.
Now we'll look at the one film festival that's just for kids, the Kids First Film Festival.
You can comment about anything you hear on the program on our talkback line. That number is 808-792-8217, or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Find us on Facebook at The Conversation, on Twitter at HI Conversation, or if you want to reach out to me, I'm at BKOZHPR.
If you miss part of The Conversation or any other show we air, you can find them on the new HPR app. Search for HPR in the Apple App Store or on Google Play. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Let's plan to meet up tomorrow for more of The Conversation.